From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. The High Court's gay marriage ruling evokes emotions ranging from euphoria to outrage. How might it play out in religious services this weekend? And why school budget cuts hit rural school districts so hard?
We have kids here who've never been to a movie theater, who've never been to a Baskin-Robbins or an ice cream place, because they don't get off of this rural hill that we live on. The school then becomes the place that we fill in all of that for many of these kids.
Also, how California helped define cool and hip in the 1950s, and he was a champion for Napa Valley wines. Robert Mondavi dies at the age of 94.
Do you realize on wine alone, we changed the thinking of the whole world on what Napa Valley is, and we're having fun doing it.
I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is the California Report. This week may well be remembered as a turning point in the debate over same-sex marriage. Depending on your point of view, the state Supreme Court's 4-3 ruling that California's ban on gay marriage was unconstitutional was either long overdue or overreaching by activist judges. In any case, the decision set off squeals of joy and howls of protest.
The right to marry is now equally extended to anyone who wishes to marry in the state, including lesbian and gay couples.
This is what the California Supreme Court has said. Children, you have a new role model, homosexual marriage. Aspire to it. This is a disaster, and the people need to condemn it in the most strong term possible.
The sun seems brighter. The sky is bluer. I have never been prouder of my home state than I am today.
The Supreme Court went way beyond what they should have, again, to trample the will of the people. We've spoken through proposition that people, a vast majority of people in the state of California, believe it should stay between one man and one woman, that being marriage.
We're feeling great. The first thing we did was go online and register to get our license at 8:15 on June 16th. We're scheduled to get married in the very first ceremony here at 10 o'clock. So,
marriage is the bedrock of our society. It is the bedrock of our community. It is the bedrock of our families, and it should not be messed with.
As California goes, so goes the rest of the nation. It's inevitable. This door is wide open now. It's going to happen. Whether you like it or not, this is the future, and it's now.
Thursday's gay marriage ruling by the state Supreme Court will surely be a topic for discussion in many churches, synagogues, and mosques this weekend. We asked several clergy members for their reaction to the ruling. Kevin Wood is a pastor of New Life Community Church, an American Baptist church in Burlingame.
Here's my struggle with the issue is that I don't know. I'm still struggling with my ability to really clarify what even the Bible says about it.
Jeff Garlow is pastor at Skyline Church in San Diego. That's an evangelical church with more than 2,500 congregants.
The issue for us ultimately is not the issue of marriage in California. That is only a symptom of the moral sickness within our culture, what is transpiring here. Our deeper concern is how do we walk with God? How do we obey Him? How do we honor Him? How do we be conformed to the image of His Son, Christ?
James Donahue is president of the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. I asked him what kinds of issues the ruling raises for ministers, rabbis, priests, and other religious leaders.
What really I think is most interesting about this is you see this interplay between these theological and religious beliefs on the one hand and the role of contemporary culture and everyday experience and how those two interact with one another. They're not, you know, separated. They're in constant interaction and dynamic interrelationship.
To what extent do you think this issue raises sort of black and white feelings for churches, synagogues, and religious leaders versus something that's, you know, kind of a gray area, something to think about, to contemplate?
Well, I think there's a huge spectrum here from those who would hold that, have a very negative view towards gay marriage and see it as irreconcilable with their own religious beliefs on the one hand, to those who have a much different perspective that would say that, you know, this is very much gay marriage. It would be very much within the purview of their own theological beliefs and the the positions of their traditions.
Looking back over relatively recent history, meaning the last, you know, last 50, 75 years, do you see a lot of examples or any examples where the courts and decisions the courts have made have led to changes in religious thinking?
Certainly, I think you can look at the civil rights issues. One looks at someone like Martin Luther King as the obvious contemporary example of someone who used religious discourse and religious language and yet used it in a way that it was applicable not just to religious believers but had a pertinence to all human experience and all of human society. So there are some examples, obviously, of how religion and religious discourse and religious ideas get translated eventually into popular culture, into public culture, and then the courts and the legislatures engaging in that as well.
Looking ahead to the fall and the likely constitutional amendment that's going to be on the ballot here in California, what role do you foresee for religious leaders on either side?
I think religious leaders are going to be challenged to put their best theological thinking into language that is accessible to the public, to enter into the public with a sense of both a confidence and yet humility. By that I mean that one has to go into these civil conversations with an understanding that we hold what we hold, we believe what we believe, but we do that in humility, trying to understand the truth that exists in the perspectives of others. And that's what a healthy public arena and public square really is.
James Donahue, he's president of the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. Thanks so much for your thoughts.
Thank you.
California schools got some good news this week. State budget cuts may be less drastic than originally feared. But educators say the budget is still billions short of what they need, and some school districts are still planning layoffs. In small rural school districts, losing even just a few staff members can make a big difference. Central Valley Bureau Chief Sasha Coca visited one of those remote school districts near Yosemite.
It's rodeo day at Tenaya Elementary, and kindergartners dressed in leather vests and cowboy boots, some with tiny spurs, are digging in a sandbox, hoping to find rocks spray-painted gold. They're learning about the gold rush history of their town, Groveland.
We found the big gold nugget!
These kids may not realize it, but their principal has been digging for gold, too, trying to figure out how to pay for programs still slated for budget cuts.
Do something, said his wicked stepdaddy.
Dressed in a pink cowboy hat, a red bandana, and a plastic sheriff's badge, Principal Mary Ann Quinn reads a cowboy story.
Bubba and Miss Lurleen were in the middle of a do-si-doin' when the clock struck midnight.
It's been a tough few weeks for Quinn. She and her superintendent laid off 4 of 19 teachers here. They also plan to cut a janitor, a cafeteria worker, and a bus driver. And they've reluctantly axed some of the school's most beloved programs. Next year, Tenaya Elementary may sound very different. The plan for now is to have no chorus, band, or music. No PE on the school's grassy field edged with pine trees. These kinds of cuts really hurt rural isolated schools, says Quinn. This entire district serves just 500 kids, many of them children of construction and hotel workers.
Our kids here, we live 20 miles from Yosemite. Their parents can't afford the $20 to go into Yosemite. If we don't take them, they will never see Yosemite. We have kids here who've never been to a movie theater, who've never been to a Baskin-Robbins or an ice cream place because they don't get off of this rural hill that we live on. And the school then becomes the place that we fill in all of that for many of these kids.
There's nowhere else in this tiny town to take music lessons or join a sports team. Tenaya Elementary is one of the few places kids have internet access. But the school is cutting the teacher who runs the computer lab, too. And with one less bus driver to cover this vast rural district, some kids may now spend almost 4 hours a day traveling to and from school. Plans to cut a cafeteria cook could mean the end of a free breakfast program for many low-income students here. In what seems like an elaborate game of chess, the superintendent has been shuffling around teachers.
The chick grows into a hen. What else could the chick grow into?
A chicken.
Michaela.
A chicken.
Oh, we already said, a chicken.
A rooster.
A hen or a rooster.
First grade teacher Jennifer Smith, who today works with eager six-year-olds, is planning to move to Don Pedro High School, even though she's never worked with teenagers.
In first grade, you're teaching them to be kind to their friends, to share, you know, to pay attention, to follow directions. In high school, those kids already know all that, but they like to push buttons. You know, they like to test the waters. So you do have to come up with a totally different strategy in maintaining your classroom.
The state exempts small rural high schools like Don Pedro from requiring teachers to be credentialed in specific subjects. So elementary teachers like Smith can teach high school, but the idea makes her really nervous, almost tearful.
And I'm taking a big jump, and I'll be teaching six different subjects. I'll be teaching biology, earth science, language arts, life skills, horticulture, journalism.
Smith has more seniority than the high school teacher she's bumping out of her job, but Tina Lanterskogen has the experience teaching teenagers six different subjects each day.
I don't know if she knows what to expect, you know, when she comes. And I'm going to be long gone by the time she gets here. It's not like I can sit here and hold her hand and help her out, you know. I'll be, who knows where I'll be, but I'll be out there somewhere.
Lanterskogen is a first-year teacher who left a career in business. She's bought a house here and is deeply invested in the community.
And I have a lot of friends my age who are getting into teaching now because we heard the baby boomers would be retiring and there'd be tons of jobs, you know. And so now here we are, all in student loan debt. We're all in our second careers that don't pay that well compared to the business career, and no jobs for us.
Parents here are rallying to support the teachers. They've launched an emergency fundraising campaign to save the music program. But so far, they've only raised $1,400 selling Tupperware. They know that's not nearly enough to pay a teacher's salary. School districts around the state have to submit their budgets June 30th. That's well before the state normally finalizes its budget. Here in rural Tuolumne County, the teachers who've been handed pink slips are likely not coming back, because even if the governor reduces the cuts, tiny communities like these can't pony up the dollars that San Francisco and other cities have found to make up the budget gap. For the California Report, I'm Sasha Coca in Groveland.
Winemaker Robert Mondavi died at his home in Yountville Friday morning. He was 94 years old. Mondavi championed California wines long before they were popular. He was a major force in putting Napa Valley wines on par with European vintages. In 1999, I visited with Mondavi at his winery in Napa, where he recounted his earliest memories of the family wine business.
My father always used to make wine, homemade wine. And I remember he would bring grapes into our home and in our cellar, and we would crush these grapes. In fact, we had rubber boots on. We'd crush them in the beginning with just with our rubber boots. And so I learned to make wine that way. My mother fed me wine and water when I was 3 to 4 years old, wine and water. So wine was a liquid food with me ever since I was brought up. So I think all these experiences I had with my family as I grew up had a tremendous bearing on what I'm doing today.
Your father and you had a vision for what the Napa Valley could be in terms of the wine industry that very few people had. I mean, at a time when you built this winery, there were people farming prunes and cows, dairy cows. No one was thinking of the valley as a premium wine center, which it has now become. What was it about this place that gave you that vision for winemaking?
My father was the president, was the secretary of the Italian Club, and when Prohibition came about in 1919, he was picked to go to California to buy grapes. So he located his home in Lodi, where he bought most of his grapes in that regard. So basically, Dad was one that understood the wine business. He'd been in the grape business, because he was shipping grapes to the Midwest and the East over all these years. So he knew where the best grapes were. So I have to give credit to my father. He's the one that set the whole pattern, and I had faith in him.
Very few people were drinking premium wines back then.
They weren't drinking. There were very few. You're right, very few. People from, we'll say, the Italians, the French, the Spanish, and a few of the people of that were drinking wine, but very little. It was a at that time.
Did you envision what we have today in the Napa Valley?
I envisioned quality wine, that we could make wines. I didn't think we could make wines equal to, but I knew we could make wines way beyond what they were today. So I knew we could attain a goal very close to the greatest. Well, today we can make wines, and because of our climatic condition, where our grapes mature more fully, I say consistently we can make a style equal to the finest in the world, more consistently than almost anywhere in the world. But we had an ideal situation here. I knew that. But then I knew that we had to learn how to make wine. So I took my first trip in 1962 to visit the wine-growing regions of Europe. And I found that they made each of their variety of grapes. Their Cabernet was made differently from their Pinot Noir. Their Chardonnay was made differently from the Riesling. That I adopted many of those principles here.
How was that first crush? How was the vintage?
We made a very good wine, almost sterile. You know, technically good, but not natural. It's like raising a child with love versus fear. And so here we had this wine that we made perfectly. If we needed a little acid, we added acid. If we needed this, and we filtered, we made it very brilliant. But in doing all of this, we stripped the wine of its naturalness.
Its character.
And the character. But may I say to you right now, today, the style and character of our wines are every bit as good as the greatest wines of the world, with our own style, our own character.
There are some people who say that we've had too much of a good thing in Napa Valley and Sonoma, that the development, the explosion of wineries and the wine industry has really damaged the environment, that it's changed the character of the Napa Valley. What do you say to them? Do you think they have a point?
It's changed the character, yes. But changing the character can enhance the quality of life. But it's up to us to do that. And if we have the developers come in, they'll just take advantage of this whole thing and destroy what I call the art of good living. And that's the thing we have to protect. But that's up to us.
What do you foresee in the next century for California wines?
I'm so optimistic. It isn't even funny, because right now I know we made tremendous progress in the quality of our wines in the last 33 years. Napa Valley was known 30 years ago as a medal institution. I mean, that's what we were known for. Do you realize on wine alone, we changed the thinking of the whole world on what Napa Valley is, and we're having fun doing it, and we should have fun doing it, and that's the one thing that we sometimes miss. We should have fun while we're doing these things as we go along.
Winemaker Robert Mondavi talking with us in 1999. Mondavi died Friday morning at the age of 94. I think we can all agree that California is a pretty cool place, right? Home of the iPod, Google, surf culture, Pixar, and don't forget George Clooney. In fact, California helped invent cool, and the center of it all was Los Angeles in the 1950s. Post-war Southern California was home to an extraordinary bunch of musicians, architects, designers, and artists, and they ended up defining what it meant to be hip and cool. Birth of the Cool, an exhibit celebrating that era, was originally shown at the Orange County Museum of Art. This weekend, it moves to the Oakland Museum of California, where curator Phil Linares gave us a preview tour earlier this week.
This exhibit looks at a whole confluence of design. It's furniture, it's homes, architecture, music, art. So what is it that ties it together? What is the cool aesthetic, if you will?
I guess you could say that the cool aesthetic has, in a way, two edges. In one sense, the definition of cool was defined by, say, the music of Miles Davis and Chet Baker and Dave Brubeck and Jerry Mulligan, which in a sense was a kind of emotional cool. But on the other hand, the rather stark images of the architecture, the straight lines, open areas, glass, and so on, gave it a very cool, almost dispassionate look. And so there's that kind of double edge of cool.
The Birth of the Cool exhibit is divided chronologically and by area of artistic influence. Dozens of paintings with bold colors and distinctive geometric shapes line several walls. They're a real contrast to the frenetic dribbles of paint created by Jackson Pollock during the same time period.
So these paintings here in this little bit of the gallery, these are tied together by, again, those very distinctive geometric shapes, the distinctive colors,
right.
And very different from what we were seeing at that time on the East Coast.
Oh, very, very different. Most of these paintings could be called hard-edge abstraction or classical abstraction.
Here's a painting by Carl Benjamin, 1957, called Totem Group 4. Tell us about this painting.
Well, this particular painting by Carl Benjamin is perhaps a little more active than a lot of the paintings in the exhibition. Very colorful. There are tall verticals in blue, red, orange, pale blue verticals, black accents. It's very active. In great contrast is the work of John McLaughlin, which is very stark and very cool. I'm looking at a painting that is simply four broad stripes, four broad vertical stripes, white, black, red, and white. Very systematic, very cool.
To what extent did all these different aspects of design, architecture, furniture, you know, music, all these different artistic expressions, to what extent were they influencing one another, would you say?
I think they did influence one another in the sense that the art, the architecture, the design, the furniture all tended to express a way of life, a rather casual way of life.
And the music, too, was very laid back, hip.
The music was very laid back, very hip. I can still hear Chet Baker singing, "You Don't Know What Love Is." It was one of the great, great classics of the time.
So this is a room of furniture mostly, and we've got chairs and some little bit of ceramics as well. But tell us about this room.
Mm-hmm. Well, this room contains a lot of the furniture. Here we have a selection of Eames chairs, some of the wood lounge chairs, the fiberglass Eiffel Tower chairs, and a number of other objects.
So was this furniture at the time, was this high style, was it expensive, or was this the kind of furniture you might see in any home in Los Angeles?
No, Eames furniture was the kind of furniture that you would see in many homes in Los Angeles. It was inexpensive, it was mass-produced, and it went well with just about any contemporary home. The furniture is almost ubiquitous. Despite the fact that it was designed in the late 40s, early 50s, it's still being reproduced, and they're probably selling more of it today than they did at the very beginning. But it was furnishings for the common man, in a sense.
The exhibit includes spectacular photos by Julius Shulman, photos capturing mid-century homes perched in the hills above L.A. And my favorite part, the jazz lounge.
So here we're stepping into the music room. And we've got all these great album jackets from this era. Birth of the Cool, of course, where the name of the exhibit comes from, Miles Davis. And this was released in, 1957, I believe, but it was recorded earlier.
It was recorded in New York in 1949, but it's been re-released many, many times.
In some ways, do you think Miles Davis kind of epitomizes the era with his the cool trumpet and kind of the slightly detached sound?
Yeah, I think that Miles Davis does exemplify the time. He's really national, international, in fact, but he did spend a lot of time on the West Coast. But other icons were Chet Baker, Dave Brubeck, of course, who for a time lived in Oakland. In fact, he was a student at Mills College in his day. This gallery also has a series of portraits of a lot of the jazz musicians by William Claxton. It's a whole gallery of his portraits of some of the best-known musicians, Jerry Mulligan, Ornette Coleman, Ray Charles. Here are some great pictures of an impromptu jam session.
This bass player has no pants. And this guy has no shirt. Very,
yeah.
Very casual.
Yeah, very casual. It's called Sunday Jam Session at Terry Gibbs House, North Hollywood, 1960.
Putting all this together, all these aspects of design in California in the 1950s and 60s. When people come through this exhibit, what do you hope they leave with?
Well, when visitors come to the exhibition, I hope they'll enjoy it and leave with a better understanding of the period, but I think just gain a better understanding and appreciation for the accomplishments of this particular period and understanding of Los Angeles, because Los Angeles was always thought of as not necessarily a cultural place. It's pretty hard to think of painters and architects and musicians and designers working very seriously to create what turns out to be a very important contribution to the art and design of American art history.
Well, the exhibition is called Birth of the Cool. It opens this weekend at the Oakland Museum right here in downtown Oakland. Phil Linares, thanks so much for the tour.
You're welcome.
You too can get a preview of the Birth of the Cool exhibit. We've got a photo tour at our website. It's californiareport.org. And that's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Seal Muller is the technical director. The online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our interns are Ali Tabatabai, Harry Gregory, Leanne Lucetta, and June Stinson. Joey Peters and Willie Aaron composed our theme music. The producers are Victoria Malione and Erica Kelly. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. Bruce Kuhn is the news director. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Wesley Foundation for coverage of immigration issues throughout California, and the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, rating hospital quality in California. On the web at calhospitalcompare.org.